Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for getting the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. In a moment, I'll be joined by Dan Kovalik. He's got an important new book out called The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. And we'll talk about the evidence-free allegations supported by anonymous leaks that indicate that Russia interfered in the election here in the United States last year. Dan and I are skeptical, to say the least, and I think you'll find this a productive conversation. It's made possible by generous supporters who subscribe to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Linda Gray, Judy Holloway, Steve Wozenski, and James Proscillo, who just renewed his annual subscription. Nice going, James. I invite you to join in. You can become a subscriber. It just takes a couple of minutes. Visit peterbcollins.com, click the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. And then you get to the sign-up page where you've got options, $5, $10, $20 a month, or the $50 annual subscription, which can earn you a bonus book if you are residing in the continental United States. I'm glad you're listening. I appreciate your support. Here we go. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, the author of a brand new book about Mother Russia. It's called The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. Dan Kovalik joins me today on the PBC podcast. And our opening music, one of my pet goth bands from the 80s, it's the Sisters of Mercy. Look them up sometime on your music service because I really dig their sound, and the Mother Russia tune is loaded with some interesting political references. Dan Kovalik is a labor and human rights lawyer. He's based in Pittsburgh, long associated with the Steelworkers Union, and he has published this important new book called The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. Dan, I'm delighted to be with you today.
And I'm delighted to be here with you. Thank you.
One of the things that triggered a positive connection with you and your book was an early reference to my friend Ray McGovern.
Ah, yes.
And Ray and I have been in contact for over 10 years now. I first connected with him when he appeared in a Robert Greenwald film critical of the Bush invasion of Iraq. And it is principled whistleblowers like Ray McGovern and Bill Binney and others who have led me to remain skeptical about this entire Trump-Russia narrative that's been advanced by the Democratic Party, the Clinton campaign, and embraced by the media, juiced up with lots of anonymous leaks and unnamed documents that, you know, we are told exist but we're not allowed to see. And I really appreciate that you have rushed into publication your new book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. And I want to, if I may, start with a quote from near the end of the book, because I think that you really make some very important comments here. You write, "We have been lied and misled into nearly every war we have been involved in by both the government and by the press, which seems to be captured by it. And the results of these wars, if not the aims, have been the opposite of what we were told they were. The U.S., in the name of freedom and democracy, has fought against nearly every war of liberation waged by the peoples of the Third World, and has many times partnered with right-wing fascist forces, including in Ukraine at the present. And up until 91, the U.S. has justified such reactionary wars based on claims, usually exaggerated if not absolutely false, that the USSR/Russia was somehow behind these indigenous struggles for self-determination. The current demonization of Russia will be used, and is indeed currently being used in such theaters as Ukraine and Syria, for similar purposes, to justify unjust wars that destroy the lives of poor people abroad, to sacrifice the lives of our poor, who are largely recruited into the armed forces for economic reasons, to deplete this country's rich resources on the continued buildup of our overbloated military to the detriment of much-needed infrastructure and social spending, and to greatly increase our carbon footprint. Now, you're really offering a very deep analysis of this long-running effort by the United States to blame a lot of stuff on Russia. And I recently interviewed Mel Goodman, another guy that I met through a Robert Greenwald film more than 10 years ago. Goodman was a CIA Russia analyst, and he writes about the politicization of intelligence going back to the 1980s and Robert Gates, who finally became the CIA director. And so fundamentally, this Trump-Russia scenario is not new, is it, Dan?
Yeah, not at all. And, you know, as you touch upon, I mean, Russia has been this very convenient scapegoat for our permanent war footing, certainly since World War II, but even before that. But after World War II, of course, it became an obsession, and it remains one. You know, Eric Hobsbawm, the historian, said that the hatred of Russia is in the DNA of Americans, and that's true because we have been primed to hate Russia. So it makes it a very convenient enemy. And so, yes, anytime we wanted to intervene abroad, since the first Cold War, we would say it's to fight a Soviet intervention, even if the Soviets were nowhere to be found. You know, examples of that, of course, are Chile, Nicaragua, El Salvador. I mean, the list goes on. But these are countries where the Soviet Union had no boots on the ground. Maybe we're giving some sort of humanitarian aid or whatever, but we're nominally influential, and yet we justified attacking these third world countries based on a non-existent Soviet threat, and now we've resurrected Russia as a threat for similar reasons.
And it must test well in political focus groups because the Democrats seized upon this. There was an email between John Podesta and Brent Badowski, a Democratic hack who I've known for a long time. And it was Badowski in December of 2015 who first suggested blaming the Russians for Hillary's problems. And we know that after the loss on election night, in less than 24 hours, the Clinton campaign was in high gear with the Blame Russia meme.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And obviously it's worked to some extent. It's gotten a lot of traction, certainly in the press, although I did see an interesting poll or an analysis of polls in the last couple days, which showed a real disconnect where the public was kind of not interested so much in the Russia story at all, whereas the media was very, very interested in it. And so certainly it is work with the media, who continues to push this line very, very hard.
Well, you don't want to mess with success. MSNBC has its highest ratings ever. Rachel Maddow is number one, having vanquished the sex addict Bill O'Reilly from Fox. And we know that Jeff Zucker, after the network diverted to cover other issues, said, okay, great, guys, let's get back to Russia. That's where the ratings are.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I was interviewed recently by the local Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and the journalist was asking me about my book and whatnot, and also acknowledged just how, you know, this was helping sell copies because it was a sexy issue. Because I had suggested, for example, I said, you know, if we want to talk about, you know, failures of democracy, you know, we could talk about, for example, Greg Palast's study, in which he said that the Republicans successfully knocked over a million people, mostly voters of color, off the voter rolls.
Yes, the interstate cross-check list.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And maybe they were able to steal the election that way. Now, that seems like that is worthy of front page news. Though outside of Greg Palast, I haven't seen any analysis like that. You know,
well, and Dan, with this attention on Russia, we have swept aside any potential domestic suspects for manipulating the election. And the interstate cross-check list was just one of a myriad of attempts by Republicans to suppress voter turnout by likely Democratic voters. And the media just blows right past that. I repeatedly see these analyses of low turnout by African Americans. Well, maybe there was a slight depression in the turnout from the peak for Obama, but many black Americans who went to vote found that their name wasn't on the list last November. And, you know, this is something that is played down. We're all told, you know, Russia didn't actually hack the vote count and our elections, were untainted. I mean, that is such bullshit. And, in the history of the recent history of the obvious stolen election in Florida in 2000, some people don't really accept it, but I've seen the forensics from Ohio in 2004. John Kerry won Ohio, and that was manipulated by Ken Blackwell, who now sits on Trump's Voter Fraud Commission.
Yeah, no, it's quite incredible, and I guess one does have to ask, why don't the Democrats pick up this issue? You know, why isn't this an issue that could win for them? And it's interesting. I mean, I think there's a couple things going on. Well, first of all, I think they may view the Russia hack issue and the issue of these other indigenous manipulations of the vote as somehow mutually exclusive. That is, you can't claim the Russians stole our democracy if, in fact, their democracy had been stolen already. But also, I think there is some bipartisan agreement that we're not going to discuss these things. And so, you know, you mentioned the 2000 election. Many of us thought that Gore conceded way too early, you know, and that he fled the scene too early. And the same with John Kerry in 2004. As you say, there were issues of Ohio that were brought up very quickly. And everyone says, oh, well, we don't want to cause a constitutional crisis, you know. But we have a constitutional crisis. It's not being created. It's there, and we need to take it head on. And as you say, the whole Russia issue is a distraction from this. And these problems are going to continue. You know, some people say, well, also, if you're afraid anyone hacked, you know, into election booths or could manipulate, the electoral computers, why don't we just go to paper ballots like a lot of the world has, and which is very effective? Why aren't the Democrats calling for that as a prophylactic? And no one is.
Dan, let me just expand on this because, I completely agree with you that the Democrats are very lame. And people who are members of Congress, when I've raised these issues, they go, shh, Peter, you're going to discourage people from voting. And I said, well, you don't think stolen elections discourage people from voting? And we just want to keep quiet because we might disturb people who haven't paid attention? And I'd like to expand this to the bigger picture. When we look at the Democratic claims, starting with the Clinton campaign, buttressed by the President Obama, then these lame assessments from the intelligence community, one in October, one in January, that really were fact-free, evidence-free in terms of what is available to the public, and entirely a trust-me scenario that has been advanced. And I continue to raise the question, if Obama believed this, if Podesta believed this, if Hillary believed this, why didn't they do any post-election challenges? Jill Stein had to carry the attempted recounts in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. I recently interviewed David Cobb, the Green Party campaign manager who supervised those recounts. We know that in Detroit alone, in Wayne County, there were more than 60,000 ballots that were cast that included no recorded vote for president. That's part of the undercount. That's part of the low turnout, we're told, attributed to African-American voters last year. But, you know, why didn't the Democrats fight this if they saw this constitutional crisis where they believe a foreign nation intervened in our election? They had the Electoral College. There were legal challenges. There was the certification in the Senate in early January. And the Democrats did not lift a finger. Instead, they said, well, let's study this and make sure it never happens again.
Yeah, well, yeah, it is a fascinating question. You know, one presumes that they think that somehow with Trump actually in office and them casting this daily doubt on his legitimacy because of the Russiagate scandal, I think they must believe that this is going to give them some longer-term success at the polls. They've had troubles at the polls. I mean, because even if you put aside the Clinton-Trump election, the Democrats still don't have the House or the Senate, and they've lost the last four special elections since Trump was elected. So they obviously have a problem, and somehow they think that this Russiagate scandal is going to help them, and that maybe they're better off, at least at the moment, in the opposition hurdling the Russiagate allegations at Trump rather than, you know, presiding over a divided Congress. I mean, that's all I can presume, because as you say, why wouldn't they have raised this challenge in a serious way? Why didn't Obama, as you say, when he claims to have known in July that there was this tampering going on, why did he decide to do pretty much nothing and not even tell Hillary Clinton about it? You know, these are things, I guess, that we'll probably know in the fullness of time.
Well, and Dan, after the election was called in November, Obama had 2 months where he could have declassified any information that would have helped us understand this alleged Russian scheme. He could have taken many steps to delegitimize Trump before he was installed. And
yeah,
he didn't.
Although that may point to the fact that there may not be much there, you know, that there's not much pointing to the Russian hacking. And this is a story that's being pushed for this political reasons. I mean, that you know, as you say, that's highly suggestive of something, because he could have done those things and didn't do it. So,
and let me pick up on something you said a moment ago, this idea of, okay, you know, the Democrats didn't win, but we have basically embedded these traps for Trump that will limit his range of capability as president. And I would submit that we are, you know, in the midst of one of those actions right now, with the Senate having passed these tough new sanctions on Russia based on who knows what. I mean, this is a political move that is driven by a media firestorm. But, you know, these are sanctions that are not based on public evidence that Russia, in fact, you know, conducted any nefarious activities. And so these are some of the most extreme sanctions, including handcuffs on the president's ability to unravel the sanctions without congressional approval. And this really fits the idea of the deep state putting limits on the range of options available to Trump. Now, I would submit that I don't trust Trump, and I think Putin can play him like a fidget spinner. But at the same time, I don't support using the secret powers of the deep state to put chains or you know, some sort of fencing around the president of the United States.
Especially when it comes to this issue. I mean, and that is the irony, that the one issue the Democrats have seized upon, this Russia issue vis-a-vis Trump, is the one issue that, frankly, of all of Trump's policies, actually makes some sense, right? So what the Democrats have done, either wittingly or unwittingly, is painted Trump into a corner whereby he will have no choice but to act in aggressive ways towards Russia in order to prove that he's not a puppet of Putin. And so, in fact, the Democrats, by their conduct, are pushing Trump closer and closer to war. And so that is what is most troubling, that the issue that they've seized upon is quite destructive. And in fact, some Democrats have gone so far as to say that we should bomb Russia because of this alleged hacking. And that's, of course, the height of insanity. Who would say such a thing, given that we're both nuclear powers? But that's how far this lie, let me say, has gone, that now to back it up, people are saying we should actually go to war, and that it's the Democrats and even rank-and-file liberals who are supporting this is a bit mind-boggling.
Well, and it is based on faith in the deep state, in the intelligence community. And that's one of the benefits of your book, Dan. You take us back to the Cold War, to Central America, to the lies of WMD, the lies that were used by Obama and Clinton to support the intervention in Libya. And this is a long arc. And to see progressives who were so skeptical of government under Bush and who regained trust under Obama, who didn't deserve it. He extended our war footprint. He used drones with abandon. He expanded the domestic surveillance state and helped roll up Occupy and the Standing Rock protests, just to name a few things. And so to see people put blind trust in Rachel Maddow, who reports the latest anonymous leak, and who presents as fact things that are clearly unproven. You know, they've abandoned the journalistic practice of saying alleged and reported and reputed and according to. It's just Russia interfered in our election. And this is all based on, facts that are not available to the public, if they exist at all.
Yeah, well, and I think that's a good point. I mean, I think Americans, unfortunately, are very quick to forget history, and they forget the last war that they were lied into, and so it's easy to lie them into the next one. You know, I've compared, Americans' kind of view of history is like Groundhog Day, that history starts over every single day, and so you don't learn from your errors, and you don't learn from the errors of having believed the intelligence communities when they lied to you before in other wars. You know, when we were lied into the war in Vietnam through the Gulf of Tonkin, lied into, of course, the war in Iraq because of alleged WMDs, etc. So it's this lack of history that allows us to continue repeating these terrible errors. And meanwhile, there also is at play this unfortunate, instinct of Americans to essentially give their party that they support a pass on whatever they do. So under Obama, as you say, if he wanted to go to war with Libya, fine. If he wanted to, support these insurgents in Syria, fine. If he wanted to double down in Iraq and Afghanistan, fine. And the liberals really did cede the ground to him. This, a lot of the same people who marched against the Iraq War, quite correctly, said nothing when Obama wanted to engage in these wars. And what also happens is, because they ceded the ground so much to Obama, frankly, they're not even challenging Trump on those issues, right? So the one bump that he got in his ratings was when he shot those 59 Tomahawk missiles at Syria. That is the one thing that can help a president. And, of course, given where Trump is now in his ratings and how his ability to maneuver is now being closed off, it's quite concerning that, in fact, he may choose a war to get him out of this position.
And by responding only as a bully would to North Korea, a bully has to engage with another bully who challenges him. I believe Trump is putting us at risk and giving attention, which is the only thing that Kim Jong-un really wants.
Yeah, exactly. And I just, in fact, saw a Washington Post alert came across my screen that's saying something to the effect that North Korea will be able to have a nuclear-capable intergalactic missile by the end of the year. Well, who put that out? You know, clearly that's being put out in order to encourage some sort of strike against North Korea. So, yeah, I mean, it's very troubling. We could be in a major war on a number of fronts with possibly North Korea, possibly Iran, God forbid Russia, you know, unless there's some sane voices that stand up and say, hold on a second, you know, this is not what we want to be doing.
Dan, you subtitled your book, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. There are many different perceptions of the deep state. What is yours?
Well, I see the deep state as these institutions, for example, the CIA, the FBI, even the Defense Department, the State Department. There's all these institutions that have, you know, career employees in there, you know, who continue throughout administrations. And so because that's the case, they can be immune largely to the sentiment of the electorate because they're not voted into office and they continue, you know, regardless of who is in office. And so they can and do have an agenda of their own. And that is quite concerning, especially when you're talking about military or intelligence services. If they have an agenda of their own that they can push, which they do seem to have, one then questions, do we truly have a civilian control of government? One great example of this, I think, was in September of last year. You may recall that Obama and Putin had come to some agreement in Syria on a peace deal with Syria, which was scuttled within several days when the U.S. military bombed Syrian soldiers outside Damascus, killing like 68 soldiers or something, and that scuttled the peace agreement right away. Well, how can something like that happen? You know, how can your military do something which seemed intentional to scuttle a peace plan that your own president had agreed to? Clearly, there are forces with a life of their own who can do things despite what your elected president, what your elected officials may want, and people should be very concerned about that.
Mm-hmm. Dan, I don't know if you follow the website consortiumnews.com, Robert Perry.
Absolutely. Good stuff. Yeah.
They have done the best job of skeptical reporting on this entire Trump-Russia narrative. And just the other day, they published another open letter from the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS. Did you get a chance to see that one? It's about the forensic look at the DNC leak.
I did see that. I saw that yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And they, and that group has been saying for some time that they thought, in fact, that information from the DNC computer was leaked by an insider, not hacked. And now they're explaining there's been this independent forensic investigation into it, which suggests, in fact, that that is the case, that that apparently the way the information was taken was done, you know, in a way that appears it was not a hack at all, but a leak.
Copied.
The
key finding is that the transfer of the data occurred before the date that has been widely published, July 5th, and that it occurred at a very high rate of speed. They were able to copy 1,976 megabytes of data in 87 seconds. Now, that is not possible with a remote hack, whether it is from across the street or from a bunker in Moscow. And this I think, is critical information. I don't regard it as, you know, evidence that refutes everything that has been alleged, but I think it is very important. They also establish a timeline showing that Julian Assange announced on June 12th that he had DNC documents that he planned to publish. And the focus has always been on July 5th events, as reported by the company that was hired by the DNC to review the server without, offering the same access to the FBI or any other law enforcement agency. So when we look at this, I find this highly persuasive, and it deeply undermines the original claim that really is the foundation of this entire narrative arc, which is that Russia hacked the DNC and weaponized that data by giving it to WikiLeaks.
Right, and the other thing they indicate is that they, I guess somehow they can even tell that the information was accessed on the east coast of the United States, not in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is powerful information, and certainly information in an analysis worth being given some spotlight in the mainstream press, but there's nothing.
Right.
None of that. You have to go to Consortium News to find this, because you're not going to find it anywhere else. And that is actually the incredible part, that you never hear the possible other side of the story. As you say, it may not be conclusive, but it certainly is worth getting out to the American public so they can make up their own minds.
It's every bit as credible as all of the anonymous leaks and the unseen documents that we're told exist.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And here is a central problem that I have. I have actually done podcasts where I play back Rachel Maddow's narrative from her TV show and talk back to it. And I do it to point up the fact that Rachel Maddow has not permitted a single critic of her theories to come on the show and say, well, Rachel, I don't think we can actually prove that. It came from a single anonymous source. And yes, it was reported by more than one outlet, but that doesn't create a second source or a third source to really verify the unproven claims that have been advanced. And so this does really evolve to conspiracy theory propaganda, because they do not permit dissenting voices or any real challenge to the narrative that they are promoting.
Well, that's exactly right. And I can give a few more examples of that. You mentioned Ray McGovern, an ex-CIA analyst who has a very different view of the Russiagate story, who thinks is very skeptical that Russia hacked the DNC computer or otherwise interfered in the election. I was at a meeting where he indicated that he had been interviewed by NPR, an NPR reporter, for 1 hour about his view on Russiagate, and then was told after the interview that it would not air on NPR because the guys in corporate, as the reporter said, wouldn't go for it. And so he ended up never being on NPR. Noam Chomsky's never been on NPR. Then you look at a reporter like Seymour Hersh, who has this other view of what happened with the alleged chemical attack in Syria earlier this year.
Yeah.
He's now having to publish his stuff in a German paper called Welt. I never even heard of it before. But dissenting voices continue to be pushed farther and farther out of the mainstream media. And so all you get is one side of the story.
Dan, we also have a dangerous new version of McCarthyism. And let me tell you a quick story. I recently agreed to an interview with a guy I'd never heard of before. It was for a local cable channel, kind of a Wayne's World thing. And because I ask strangers like you to grant me an interview, when somebody asks for an interview, I generally say yes. And so this guy who interviewed me, his name is Michael Killen, and he had clearly spent about an hour looking at my podcasts and cherry-picking a few items. So he said, huh, you don't believe the Trump-Russia narrative? I said, no. And I said, my source is Bill Binney, the former technical director of the NSA. And this guy Killen said, oh, Bill Binney. I looked him up online and I found this article at Sputnik, and it was just showering praise on Bill Binney. And he said, isn't Sputnik a Russian outlet? And I said, yes, it is. And I said, what are you inferring? And then he said, well, on another Google search, I found out that Bill Binney had been arrested. And I said, yes, he was arrested. It was in retaliation for his honorable whistleblowing about wrongdoing that he observed when he was technical director at the NSA. And he persisted with another comment about the Russian implications of Bill Binney's commentary. And I interrupted him and I said, Michael, that's bullshit. And as he continued, I said, Senator, have you no shame? And I was referring to Joe McCarthy in 1953. And the casual way in which this man was willing to smear Bill Binney, who has paid a big price for his honorable whistleblowing, really shocked me. And the way people are prepared to embrace the unproven narratives of Russian interference in our election, and then demagogue those of us who are skeptical in this form of new McCarthyism, I find really frightening.
It really is. And again, it's a way to drown out dissent. You know, in this country, they don't, you know, if it's rare that you get killed for being a dissenter or put in jail, but what they do is assassinate your character, you know. And another example of that is Oliver Stone with his Putin interviews. I mean, he was utterly trashed by the media. I don't know if you saw the Stephen Colbert interview, but it was disgraceful.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And I watched the Stone interviews with Putin. I found them fascinating. I wouldn't say that Oliver is the most hard-hitting interviewer that I've ever seen, but he really allowed Putin to speak. And for example, you know, he was criticized, Stone was, for not hammering Putin over his position on gays. But Putin, by talking about how, you know, he wouldn't want to be in a shower with a gay man, he exposed himself as a homophobe. And
right.
I didn't need anything further than that to understand who he is and you know, what he believes. And yet, you know, a lot of people hammered Stone for not being politically correct and, you know, really indicting him for his views on homosexuality.
No, exactly. And in the end, you know, it was portrayed that Stone was some kind of, again, some sort of a Putin apologist or whatnot. And again, it's heartbreaking because here's a guy who's won three Oscars, who volunteered to fight in Vietnam, who quit Yale to volunteer for Vietnam, Oliver Stone. And he's treated as if he's a schmuck, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you see this more and more. And even Seymour Hersh, a guy who's won a Pulitzer, is belittled in the press if he's mentioned at all. And so to get one's dissenting voice out there is so difficult. And it is a struggle every day to get your message out there.
And Dan, have you been McCarthyized?
Well, yes, certainly, to some degree. Obviously, I'm not as on big of a stage as some of the folks we mentioned. But, yes, certainly people, even friends, you know, when they heard that I was writing this book, were very critical of me and made it clear that they didn't even like the idea I was writing it. And, you know, people are very upset about the book because they somehow think it's disloyal to themselves or the Democrats, who they're so closely aligned with, and to the liberal cause, that somehow it's giving a fig leaf to Trump or whatever. Or again, apologizing for Putin, when in fact, as you know, if you've read the book, it's really just calling for a sane, you know, kind of rational analysis of the U.S. role in the world and the U.S. role towards Russia that I think we're in dire need of.
Well, and you provide accurate history and context for this current imbroglio, I think is the best way to describe it. I hope that people will read your book and get a sense of where reality lies, how often we have been lied to by our government and the deep state, particularly about Russia, and that we have to, despite the idea that this could be a path to remove Donald Trump from office. You know, I don't believe that the end justifies the means. I have a good friend in Texas. He's a retired journalist, Dan. And he's kind of telling me, Peter, you're on the wrong side of this. And Trump is this existential evil. And it doesn't matter what pretext we use to get rid of him. This appears to be the best available one. So will you please shut up and let us stage a coup? That's what many people are either suggesting or embracing without thinking about it.
Absolutely. And as you say, you know, the ends don't justify the means, especially when the means could lead to a war with another nuclear power, which is a huge issue. But also, even practically speaking, if you did get rid of Trump, you'd end up with Pence, which could be even worse, you know. So there doesn't seem to be any really end game here for this whole plot based on Russiagate. It just does not seem to have an end that's going to end well for the Democrats or for the interest of peace. And so those of us who are critical need to raise our voices against it.
And Dan, let me make this assertion and get your reaction. I believe that if Barack Obama had not engaged in obstruction of justice when he said, we're going to look forward, not backward, and he failed to investigate or prosecute Wall Street criminals, war criminals, torture criminals, surveillance criminals, and he basically just said, you know, let's just let those sleeping dogs lie. Well, I believe that that has pacified many Americans, particularly those who were quite active against the George W. Bush administration. And I think you touched on this earlier. It's allowed that passivity to continue in the face of a much more, let me put it this way, a guy who presents as more mercurial and dangerous than Obama did. And yet many people are just kind of oblivious and, you know, whatever, keep Guantanamo open. It doesn't matter to me. We can privatize the war in Afghanistan, whatever, man, I don't care. And so the average American has either given up hope that they can have any influence, or they've just accepted that, well, you know, this is my government. I'm an American, so I'll just fall in line.
Well, I think that's exactly right. You know, it reminds me of something my dad used to say. He used to argue that accepting that really evil was allowed to happen incrementally, you know, and you make allowances for small evils, and then, you know, over time you've made allowance for great ones. And I think you touch upon that. I think because Obama essentially gave his imprimatur to the drone war, to Guantanamo, even though he said he was going to close it, as you say, to war criminals, and that people were okay with that, in part because it was just Obama doing that, and he thought he was a good guy somehow, that then people get used to accepting all sorts of things. And that's a real dangerous thing. And frankly, you know, nice is as nice does. You know, you're a good person if you do good things, and if you do bad things, you're not so great, you know. And this kind of deification of Obama is quite bizarre because, while, yeah, he seems like a nice guy, nice family guy, well-spoken, handsome guy, you know, you kind of like him on the surface. He did terrible things as president, many of the same things that Bush had done, that people marched against, and that we allowed him to not only get away with that, but now to be considered this great statesman, really, I think, puts this country in grave jeopardy.
And if a single CIA official or high-ranking Bush administration officer had been indicted for the lies that led us into Iraq, for the phony intelligence that was used to support that, we would have a very different deep state today. And I believe that Obama's failure to really follow the law and, you know, let the chips fall where they may, really created the climate, the atmosphere that we are contending with today.
Well, I think that's a very good point. I think, as you say, he essentially gave a pass to people who lied us into war, and those same people are still there lying us into the next war and lying, you know, they lied us into the war in Libya, for example, as well. And yeah, he did not take a stand when he could have, and frankly, when it seemed like he had popular support to do that. And now we're stuck in a position where, you know, we even have a worse guy in power who now has the reins on this, you know, devastating intelligence and military power, and where is he going to go with it? You know, now who knows? But yeah, the choices that Obama made in not stopping those things when he could have, has now put us in a very precarious position where, you know, Trump is it could be poised to do all sorts of things.
Dan, I want to talk to you about one other topic before we wrap up. Is there anything else on the Trump-Russia scenario that you wanted to comment on that I haven't asked you about?
Well, just, you know, the one thing that comes to mind, we talked a bit about kind of this new McCarthyism and that sort of thing, you know, where it's gotten to the point that even though when they found out, for example, that Trump had a private meeting with Putin during the G20, that people reacted like that was somehow treasonous, you know, when, of course, this sort of thing happens, you know, all the time, right? Now, every time you meet with a Russian, you're somehow tainted, right? And I just find that quite bizarre. Again, the one thing that Trump, positive thing that he seemed to offer was that he wanted to have some detente with Russia. And there is now a concerted effort to prevent that, and I think that that's quite scary. So even while he made some agreements with Putin on Syria and Ukraine, you see that the U.S. just put Patriot missiles on the Russian border for the first time ever. And, you know, so there are other things happening where we are hardly out of the woods yet in terms of a possible confrontation with Russia. And all of this Russia baiting is only pushing us further towards that type of confrontation.
And Dan, just to tag on to your point about that chit-chat after dinner at the G20 summit in Hamburg and the hysteria that followed in the liberal media, I have to laugh when I say that. My friend Norman Solomon is an outspoken advocate, and he published a column recently criticizing Congresswoman Barbara Lee. And he put it in this context that, you know, she's been a hero to us on the left because she was the only one who voted against the authorization for use of military force and the Patriot Act after 9/11. And she recently led the charge that was ultimately stripped out of the defense bill that would have repealed that 2001 AUMF. And nevertheless, she tweeted criticism of Trump, chatting with Putin at the G20 summit and suggested, I don't think she used the word treason, but that, it was wrong and inappropriate. And while, you know, I kind of pick my targets, I have to agree with Norman that this is out of character for Barbara Lee to be joining this Democratic pack mentality that Trump is a puppet of some sort of Putin's and that any contact, has to have some sort of chaperone. I just think that we are seeing how some smart Democrats have gotten sucked into this this narrative.
Yeah, and it shows how dangerous the narrative is, as you say, when you have good people, otherwise good people who have been voices of peace, who now seem to be rattling the sabers for war. It's a grave, grave concern. I'm very familiar with Norman Solomon, and I saw that piece, which I thought was excellent. By the way, he's read my book and seems to like it as well, which I really appreciate.
And you got a fiery introduction from San Francisco's David Talbot, which
yes, indeed.
I enjoyed too.
Actually, it seems like my biggest fan base is in the Bay Area, as far as I can tell. So,
well, come on out and see us. We'd love to have you.
Actually, I will be there in September. I will be on a little book tour in September, September 7th through the 11th.
Okay.
So hopefully I will see you there.
I'd love to get on your calendar and have another conversation then. Dan, before I let you go, when I looked you up online, I discovered that, and your book also details your own activist involvement in Central America going back to the 1980s and the era of Iran-Contra. And you also have spoken up about the ongoing crisis in Venezuela. And one of the things that really bothers me is that American media coverage, including in the New York Times and the Washington Post, is so biased. And it simply paints Nicolas Maduro as this has-been socialist and that, he's presiding over this cratering country. And they rarely even bother to mention that if the price of oil rebounded and headed north, up above $60, $70 a barrel, that the Venezuelan economy would recover because 80% of their foreign exchange comes from oil. And so it is the oil economy that has Venezuela on its knees, but it's always targeted as a failed socialist society. And I'd like to just hear your comments on the current situation. It is dire. There are protests that turn violent almost every day. And Maduro has convened a national vote to elect a constituent assembly to redraft the Constitution. That has now been scheduled for July 30th. What do you make of the scene there? And to what extent is the U.S. covertly working to destabilize the Maduro government?
Yes, well, first of all, I will be in Caracas for that vote on Sunday, and I have been there a number of times in recent years. And yes, I have a lot of feelings about Venezuela. I feel like the press's portrayal of Venezuela is incredibly skewed. As you indicate, when Chavez was in power and things were going, pretty well, the oil was at over $100 a barrel. We're now under $50 a barrel, and as you indicate, it devastated Venezuela's economy. So to put that all on the shoulders of Nicolas Maduro is incredibly unfair. Meanwhile, you have these protests, which, again, the media portrays the violence is all coming from the state, when in fact it appears most of the violence is coming from these protests, which are largely being organized by the wealthier segments of society. There have been lynchings by these protesters on the street many times of Afro-Venezuelans. It is hardly the story of a repressive state against the people. It is a complex situation. Obviously, Maduro is in a political crisis, and obviously the U.S. government has been stoking that, has been putting millions of dollars towards supporting various civil groups in Venezuela to oppose Maduro. At the same time, obviously Maduro has made his own mistakes, but again, the idea that he is some villain in this story is incredibly unfair, and in many ways, I have some respect for Maduro for trying to weather a very difficult situation, which is in many ways out of his hands, as you say, given the oil prices. And even notwithstanding all that, recent polls have shown that people distrust the opposition much more than they distrust Maduro, that 75% of Venezuelans still support socialism in that country. And again, we'll see what happens on Sunday, but I think Maduro still has very strong support in the poorer communities. And I think for those of us on the left, I think the Venezuelan government deserves our support.
And the recent release from prison of Leopold Leopoldo, who is a major leader of the wealthy opposition to the Maduro government, has that changed the chemistry much?
I think certainly it should, to some extent at least, it should. Again, the media should have given some kudos to Maduro for that move. I don't think he got much credit for that. But in any case, it probably has emboldened the opposition to some extent, which probably has just inflamed things even more. He's been very outspoken in support of of these protests, notwithstanding the fact that they've turned violent many times. So I think the opposition probably has gotten some wind under their sails because of that. But you know, we'll see. It's a tough time. But as I say, the polls certainly show that the opposition actually is lacking a lot of support in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for those comments. It's hard to get anything that counters the American nationalist anti-Maduro line that really predominates in the corporate media in this country. Dan, it's a real pleasure to meet and chat with you. Dan Kovalik is the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. It's out in softcover right now, and it's from Skyhorse Publishing. I highly recommend it. Dan, thanks for joining me today.
Peter, thank you. It was a real pleasure for me.
Thanks for listening to my in-depth interview with Dan Kovalik. You got comments? Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.